For the week of December 11th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 129, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, how is New York these days?
Well, maybe it wasn't a good idea to eat peanut butter right before the show.
No. Unless you're doing a Got Milk commercial, I think you're pretty much better off not eating peanut butter or anything crunchy.
I'm going to keep sipping my tea to try and work this out.
Well, I can tell you the caffeine won't help.
Oh, it's decaf.
In any case, we've got a real treat for you on today's show. During Inside Baseball, we're going to be talking to Dean Budnick and Josh Barron, the authors of Ticketmasters, The Rise of the Concert Industry, and How the Public Got Scalped. Now, anybody who is a fan of music and has tried to get good tickets to see their favorite bands in concert knows how difficult it can be. Dean and Josh will explain why that is and how it came to be. The year is winding down, which means film critics throughout North America sit around coffee tables deciding which movies were the best of the year. The consensus is that there is no consensus. The Black Keys released a new album last week, but you won't find it on Spotify, RDO, Mog, or even Rhapsody. Trust me, I tried looking for it. Some big name acts are pulling their titles from the music subscription services, and we'll tell you why. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, and end with some correspondence from listeners. In fact, we won't be ending with some correspondence from listeners. We're going to hold them until next week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
The weekend box office figures from around the world are coming in slowly this week. I'm not quite sure why. Perhaps it's because this was one of the slowest weekends at the box office in 3 years in North America. And the same is not true around the world. But for some reason, getting all the numbers together this week has been a bit of a trial. But right now, the number one movie around the world with the latest figures that we have is Puss in Boots, the DreamWorks film that's a spinoff from Shrek. It grossed $47 million worldwide. It expanded to quite a few new territories. Kids have been let out of school in a lot of Europe. And so that's why this movie has jumped up to the top of the worldwide box office chart. It's at $284 million worldwide and counting. It has quite a ways to go. There's a lot of money to be made.
You're not saying that kids have been let out of school because of Puss in Boots. They've been let
that's
out
right. The school said, we can't have you in school as long as Puss in Boots is in the film theaters. No, okay. It's just school let out, and therefore Puss in Boots, you know, opened in those territories to take advantage of the full day of movie-going opportunity the kids had.
Okay.
If those kids are teenage girls, they might have gone to see Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 1.
Is this where I scream if I'm a teenage girl? Do I scream here or when you're done talking about it?
When I'm done talking.
Okay.
That movie is number two around the world. It grossed $27 million worldwide. It's at $633 million. It's certain to end up at around $700 million worldwide, just like all the other movies in the franchise. And number three around the world is New Year's Eve, sort of a franchise film from Gary Marshall. They did Valentine's Day. Now they have New Year's Eve. Next will be Arbor Day, I imagine. This movie grossed $26.6 million around the world. At number four, showing some strong momentum, is Arthur Christmas, the Aardman film that we're all very supportive of. It grossed $21 million worldwide. It has great reviews. It's at $91 million and counting. It is not based on the PBS story character Arthur. It's not a spinoff of Arthur, the drunken millionaire. It is Arthur Christmas, an original film from the creators of Wallace and Gromit, and you should go see it.
Indeed. It's a great movie. Again, I urge everyone, walk, don't run, or vice versa. Run, don't walk, to your nearest theater to see Arthur Christmas.
At number five around the world is Happy Feet 2, which grossed $14 million worldwide. It's at $106 million and counting. This is not a success story. It probably won't turn out to be one. My brother and his kids saw it. They didn't like it either, unfortunately. At number six is The Sitter, the Jonah Hill comedy, which opened in North America only. It grossed $10 million around the world. And number seven is The Muppets, which has just started to open up overseas. It has grossed $8.2 million around the world this weekend and a total of $71 million and counting. And number eight is The Adventures of Tintin, the Steven Spielberg, Peter Jackson extravaganza. It grossed $8 million worldwide. It's at $233 million and counting. Of course, it opens up in North America in a week and a half. I still think this total is a bit low for this movie. They needed to make a lot of money overseas because this is not a property that's well known in North America. At number nine is Hugo, the Martin Scorsese film, which grossed $6 million. It's basically open in North America only. It's at $33 million and counting. And at number 10 is the George Clooney film The Descendants, which grossed $4.8 million. It's at $23.6 million worldwide and counting. The French hit Intouchables, which we've been talking a lot about, The numbers for that film were not available from France yet. They'll be coming in later this afternoon, I imagine. That would probably be in the $10 to $12 million range if it's still holding steady. It's a remarkable phenomenon. It's definitely going to pass $100 million this weekend. The biggest news, I guess, in North America is that number one, this is the slowest weekend in 3 years. And number two, that a number of movies are doing very well in limited release. Movies like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Young Adult, which is the Jason Reitman film based on the Diablo Cody script. The Artist is still doing very well in limited release. My Week with Marilyn. So all those movies are bubbling under, and when they get wider releases, we'll see how they pan out. But they're certainly getting a lot of attention in limited release.
Well, do you think that's because it's the end of year and everybody's expecting them to be on everybody's Oscar shortlist? Or is it because the studios are just making some god-awful movies?
Why are they limited? No, there's a different game. I mean, the movies are doing well in limited release because people want to see them. You know, that's it. If a movie has got attention and interest, people will go see it. Whether it will work when you expand it to 500 or 1,000 screens, that's another question. But it's not the fact that somebody said, oh, gee, I don't think The Sitter or New Year's Eve looks very good. I think I'll go see Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. You know, that's just not how it works, really.
Well, especially since, you know, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is playing on a whopping 4 screens throughout the entire continent. So, yes, I would agree with you on that.
So they're doing well because they're getting good reviews and people are interested in them. Whether this will pan out over the next number of weeks, that's the question. You know, it's not easy to do well in limited release. It's always a good sign. Of course, you don't want to open up on 4 screens and have nobody show up. That can happen too. But it's a very big difference between being on 4 screens and doing well and being on 400 screens and doing well.
I'm really interested to see how The Artist, which is this black and white silent film, we both saw it in Cannes, we both loved it, we recommend you see it, but I'm really interested to see how that plays to a wider audience.
Well, it's a very audience-friendly movie. It's not like Tinker Tailor, which I know people who have seen it and really like it, but it's certainly a serious movie you got to really pay attention to. It's subtle and difficult to follow, and Shame, which is about a sex addict or a dangerous method about, you know, Carl Jung and Sigmund Freud. The Artist is a pure popular entertainment on every level. Obviously, movie buffs will love it even more, but anybody who sees it can and should enjoy it. It's not obviously for everybody, but it's a very fun, friendly comedy, romantic film that I think will appeal to a wide audience. And I think the Weinsteins are going to play it right. They're just going to platform it out slowly, build on the end of the year attention that it's getting. And I'm sure that the wide release will come the weekend that the Oscar nominations are announced.
Probably right. Now, New Year's Eve, you mentioned that it's kind of a franchise film. It's kind of a, you know, Gary Marshall, who directed Pretty Woman and many other films. He is doing these ensemble films on holidays. So Valentine's Day was, I guess, last year. This year, it's New Year's Eve. You mentioned Arbor Day will probably be next. I mean, I know that was a joke, but why do all of these movie stars keep, you know, appearing in these films when they are so awful?
Well, Valentine's Day made $100 million, at least, I think, in North America. It was a successful film. Gary Marshall's been around a long time. He has a lot of appeal. These people are appearing in very small roles. You know, it's a big ensemble film, but it's not like Nashville where they have to keep crossing paths with each other. Basically, it's probably a very quick shoot for, I'm sure it's arranged that they can do their bit in, you know, 10 days or something, or 2 weeks, and be in and out. So, you know, you've got a lot of people. Hey, there's 20 other of their best friends are in the movie. It's fun. You're done in 2 weeks. It's easy. It's simple. You know, why not?
Well, I think it's safe to say that we're not going to see New Year's Eve on any year-end lists like the ones that started to come out this week.
That's right. I mean, there's waves and waves of a best of the year list coming out. This week, we've had a bunch more. We'll do the less important ones first. The American Film Institute came out with their 10 best films of the year. They gave special awards to The Artist and Harry Potter because those were not eligible for various reasons. The New York Film Critics Online gave attention to The Artist, which they named the best picture of the year.
Wait a second. Did you want to mention what the AFI said?
Oh, did I not even do it?
Yeah, you mentioned the special awards and then just skipped right over the top 10 films.
Well, they list 10 films. They're in alphabetical order, right? They're not listed. Did they name a top film of the year?
I think they just say, here are the top 10 films of the year in alphabetical order.
Right. It's Bridesmaids is alphabetically the first on the list. Then The Descendants, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Help, Hugo, J. Edgar, Midnight in Paris, Moneyball, The Tree of Life, and War Horse, which I'm seeing tomorrow night. Of those 10, I certainly wouldn't list 7 on my favorite of the year, but there you go.
Okay. So now let me guess the 7. Tree of Life, you probably would.
Right. It's quicker to name the ones I might have on my list.
Right. And I would imagine that...
The other two I haven't seen. I haven't seen The Descendants or War Horse. So.
Oh, okay. So I know The Help you wouldn't. And J. Edgar, no, I'm surprised it's on the AFI's list, frankly.
Well, no, it's sure to be an Oscar contender and up for acting awards. I saw it this weekend. I found it unbearable. But there you go. I mean, I really did.
Tell us how you really feel.
No, it was embarrassing. But there you go. But again, all these critics are not that wildly important. The New York Film Critics Online, they listed their 10 best films of the year. At the top of the list was The Artist. Best actor was Michael Shannon for Take Shelter. Meryl Streep for The Iron Lady got Best Actress, and so on. Albert Brooks got more momentum for his hoped-for Oscar bid for Drive. And Melissa McCarthy, who won the Emmy Award for her TV sitcom, got noticed for Bridesmaids. Then there's Boston Film Critics. They also like The Artist, but their best director is Martin Scorsese. Their best actor is Brad Pitt for Tree of Life and Moneyball. Best actress is Michelle Williams. San Francisco Critics, they love The Tree of Life. The Tree of Life, Terrence Malick. They gave some attention to Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. That was Gary Oldman, and so on and so on. The Annie Awards listed their 10 best animated films of the year, including Arthur Christmas, Kung Fu Panda 2, Puss in Boots, and Rango. Oh, and The Adventures of Tintin. But the most important one of all this week's batch, is the LA Film Critics. Their best picture is The Descendants. Their best director is Terrence Malick. Their best actor is Michael Fassbender for 4 movies. Their best actress, quite a good performance, is Young Jung-hee, a major artist in Korea who was nominated for Poetry, in which she plays an old woman who is struggling with Alzheimer's. I saw it at Cannes. It's a very good performance and a good movie. I apologize for butchering her name. And Christopher Plummer getting a little more attention for Beginners, so he's hopefully going to be gunning for an Oscar. I'm sure he's rooting for that. And Jessica Chastain got Best Supporting Actress for a string of movies. So what you get when you list all these movies, The Descendants, Tree of Life, The Artist, Hugo, all these different movies that got attention, it's clear that there's no front runner.
Yes, that's correct. And why do you say that the Los Angeles Film Critics is probably the most important out of the batch? I can understand why you would say... Well, I can understand why you would say, hey, the LA Film Critics Association is a little bit more important than the New York Film Critics Online. I get that. But why the LA Film Critics as opposed to the San Francisco Film Critics or Boston Film Critics?
Well, I think they've been doing it for longer. I don't know about that. I feel like the New York and LA were the first. Maybe some other city was first. I could be wrong about that. But they just have a longer history of being important and influential as far as nudging films towards Oscar, giving movies attention. They just have a more prestigious aura about them. Maybe that's unfair. You know, the Chicago film critics include Roger Ebert, the first critic to win the Pulitzer Prize. There are great critics in Boston and San Francisco, but New York and LA are the two lodestars. They're just their film centers, their film communities, their awards, because, you know, the LA Times is covering it. They get a lot more coverage, and the New York Times covers the New York film critics. So they just have a lot more gravitas and pull. All these others sort of bubbled under. And what happens is New York and LA matter. And then the Golden Globes matter. And what really matters is, of course, the Oscars.
Well, yes, of course. Well, and what I found interesting about the LA Film Critics announcements was that, one, they were being announced on Twitter by some of the members of the LA Film Critics as they were being nominated. Or as they were being selected. In fact, when they got to Best Picture, chuckles arose in the room as somebody's phone went off with the Muppet theme.
Well, you know, the New York Film Critics had an official Twitter feed and they announced their winners as they arose. So this is just, you know, a quick, simple way to let people know about what's happening in the room.
Yeah, I mean, there do seem to be some refrains, if you will, and that is Jessica Chastain, Albert Brooks, certainly Terrence Malick seems to be coming up a lot in The Artist. Those seem to be the, I don't want to say they're on everybody's list, but they seem to be announced again and again in various forms.
Yes, and Hugo.
Yes.
You know, and I'm sure Woody Allen is happy to see his film on the AFI list because Midnight in Paris is definitely a contender for Oscar. I know it was his most commercially successful film. Hollywood always loves him and loves the actors in his movies. So there's a chance that he'll be on a number of categories come Oscar time. So, you know, everybody wants to grab whatever attention they can get. To Go with the Dragon Tattoo had a kerfuffle over screenings and early reviews of critics, thanks to The New Yorker. So they're happy to see the attention back on the movie and it being among the list of the 10 best films of the year, at least according to the AFI. So it all helps them as they build their campaign towards the Oscars.
Well, now, speaking of helping out art, do you think the Black Keys, who are a kind of a blues rock band, I mean, I heard them way back in 2005, 2006 at a festival, and I thought, who are these guys? These guys are really good. And they were playing some small tent off in the middle of nowhere, and nobody was showing up. And of course, now they're headliners. They released an album. Their latest album is El Camino. It was produced by Danger Mouse. And so on Tuesday, I had already ordered the album on Amazon. I was waiting for it to arrive in the mail. And I said, well, you know what? While I wait for it to arrive, let me go on to Spotify and listen to it. Well, I couldn't find it. So off to Ardio I went. I couldn't find it there either. Off to Mog, couldn't find it. Rhapsody, couldn't find it. They were nowhere to be found. And then I noticed neither was Coldplay. I couldn't listen to their latest album. I can't remember the Milo Xyloto or whatever it's called. So there are some of these bands are beginning to pull their recent releases from these music subscription services.
Well, this is fascinating. It used to be that radio was a way to get people to buy your album. You put a song on the radio for free, people hear it, and they run out and buy the album so they can listen to the song whenever they want. That's the big difference here. With the streaming services, people can sort of call up the album and listen to it
whenever
on demand.
They want. Yeah.
And so that's a very different world. And so whereas radio, people felt that helped push sales of your album or your single, the streaming services, they think, will hurt your sales because people don't need to buy it because they can hear it whenever they want on Spotify. And that's why people like the Black Keys are saying, you know what? If we're going to do that, we'll wait down the road 6 months or a year, or maybe we'll never do it. But when the album's just come out and it's most in demand, we want people to buy it so we can actually make some money on it.
Well, much like the movie industry, which has its own issues with windowing where there's a theatrical release, then a home video release, then a pay cable, so premium cable release, then a basic cable release, then a television release, here we're beginning to see in the music industry some of these windowing techniques where, okay, we'll release one song, a single to the radio, then we'll sell the album, and then maybe we'll put the whole album on Spotify for everybody else to listen to and get money that way. But I think that for people and music lovers who are our age, who are, you know, above the age of 20 and were born in the 70s and 80s, will always want to own the album in some form, whether it's buying it digitally or buying the CD. Frankly, I like physical media. Call me old-fashioned. But
old-fashioned.
Yeah, thank you. It's a good drink, by the way, if you ever have one. That might show my age, though. I'll always want to own the music, because what happens when Spotify goes away or Ardio goes away or Rhapsody gets bought by somebody and all of these licensing deals start to switch and flip over, and all of a sudden something that was available on Ardio is no longer available on Ardio, but it's available on some new service that hasn't even been invented yet. So I think that for us, we'll always want to own music, and we'll use services like this to find out which music we want to own as opposed to which music we may just want to listen to from time to time. I think for people who are like my children's age and born in the 2000s, I think they very well may grow up not believing or feeling as if they need to own the music itself.
Well, it's just like DVDs and old TV shows. When you've got them on Hulu and Netflix, why would you buy a bunch of box sets and have them on your shelf?
Yes, that's right. And I was wondering, you know, not this is completely off topic in a way, but over the weekend, I came across a bunch of DVDs that I had gotten years ago as they hadn't even been opened, in fact, as review copies. And I thought, well, what are they going to do when they start releasing these films just on digital? With digital streaming, what are they going to send to critics?
They make digital stream copies available now for TV episodes of new shows and movies. They do that already.
Yes, I guess half the appeal of being a film critic and you know, or a home video critic and, you know, really being paid peanuts was that, hey, at least you got all your movies for free. But now, of course, these distributors will send you a limited time stream and you can watch it, and then they'll take it away from you.
Yeah, luckily they can't do that yet, because when you want to review the picture quality and the sound and all that, you know, watching something on your laptop is not the same as putting in a Blu-ray and watching on your widescreen TV. So fortunately, that isn't happening yet. But you have a good point, a good idea that maybe music is developing these new windows that they haven't had before. There'll be the album release. Well, there'll be the commercial single on the radio or any service. There'll be the album release. And then maybe 6 months down the road, they'll start to put it on, you know, streaming services. Because why do that at the beginning? I think they're right that it would hurt sales.
Well, I have to, again, I'd like to point out that I personally, and I know a couple of friends who do this as well, will go on to Spotify or one of these music subscription services, and they will begin to like myself, begin to listen to music that they are interested in purchasing, and they're trying it out. It's like going to the record store, except you don't have to leave your home.
Right, of course.
And I have to hand it to Spotify. You know, one of my biggest complaints with Spotify was if you knew the music that you wanted to listen to, they were great. You could go there, search for the music you wanted to listen to, and you could hear it. No problem at all. But discovering new music or being handed new music, it was impossible to find something that you didn't already know existed. But they started to launch these apps 2 weeks ago, and they started to put these radio stations into play, and they now have a service that's somewhat like Pandora, where it will use an algorithm to find similar music that you may not know about. So they are really responding very rapidly to consumer demand and consumer suggestions.
Well, I wouldn't say rapidly, but they're doing it. But I don't think the algorithms work very well ever, period. I think they're just sort of self-reinforcing loop. I don't think it's remotely a replacement for a DJ or somebody who is a fan who can get you excited about new music that you wouldn't necessarily know you'd like until you heard it. But this is a big problem that everybody has. TV, movies, music, books, you name it. There's such a wealth of information, and getting people a way to find out what's out there, what's available, and what's good. Those portals, those people like Rolling Stone reviewing an album or Pitchfork, somebody like that, they're more important than ever, because how else are you going to figure out what's out there and what you want to hear?
No, I agree. You know, I think that the last 5 to 10 years was all about the content creation and creating the music and being Arcade Fire or distributing it. I think that the next big trend will be not necessarily the creation of the content, but the curation of the content.
Yes, exactly.
But what I thought, I don't want to overuse the word interesting, what I found surprising maybe was that part of the reason, and this is coming from the LA Times, part of the reason that some of these musicians don't want their music on Spotify or audio is because the song has to be played between 100 and 150 times on a streaming service before it amounts to the same revenue they would have earned from a single download sale.
Well, that's not news. I mean, yeah, it's download sale. If it's on iTunes, iTunes get 30% of it. So if it's sold for a dollar, that means they get 70 cents plus the cost of putting it up and other people. So they might make 50 cents or 40 cents on a sale of a single. So I'm surprised even 150 plays would get them 50 cents, but maybe it does.
Well, who knows?
But yeah, that's what we know. We know you can get your song played a million times on YouTube. You're not exactly making $1 million.
No. So I guess what you're saying, Michael, is the Windows is a big deal, but the fact that some of these music subscription services don't pay, that's kind of old news, so it's a big whoop.
And that takes us right into Big Deal, Big Whoop, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. That was my segue into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story, Ryan Seacrest might take over Matt Lauer's job on the Today Show. Are you kidding me? Will the Today Show on NBC end with words, Seacrest out? Ryan Seacrest is already the host of the number one show in prime time, the ratings and money gusher American Idol on Fox. Now the word is that he might become the anchor of the number one in morning news, NBC's massively profitable show Today. Host Matt Lauer has been toying with the idea of stepping down when his contract ends in 2012, and NBC has had preliminary talks with Seacrest about being his replacement. Seacrest has numerous deals with NBC's owner Comcast via the E! Network and other avenues, by the way. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. It puts a little pressure on Matt Lauer, shows he's not the only game in town. It would be a massive big step for Seacrest. I mean, he's got a lot of things that he does as a producer and a host and a figure on television. The Today Show would be a real jump, though. That is a wildly profitable show. He would be a much bigger figure there than he is on Idol, where he is, he is the smooth talking host. And if you watch The X Factor, you can see how useful a good host is. but the Today Show, you'd be interviewing presidents and I mean, that is a whole different level of game. And that would really be a massive platform for him for the rest of his career. It would be very profitable as well. It's a very big deal. And if you look at the morning ratings, NBC is still on top. They've been on top for years now. And, people do stories every once in a while that Good Morning America is closing the gap. Well, yeah, no, they're not. The Today Show is on top. It's the biggest moneymaker that on any network, I believe. I don't think there's a more profitable show. It has 5 hours a day that it does all week long. So it's a huge rating center for NBC. It's their best story that they have, that and football.
Let the arguing begin. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced a new batch of inductees for its ceremony in April of 2012. The honorees include the Beastie Boys, Guns N' Roses, Laura Nyro, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Small Faces, and Donovan. Among the acts eligible and knocking on the door but not making the cut, Donna Summer, The Spinners, The Cure, Joan Jett, and Eric B. and Rakim. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal for the people who made it, not to rain on anyone's parade, but the one act that stuck out for me was Donovan. I just don't think Donovan has a Hall of Fame level career. He has a few good singles. I just don't think he's that important a figure. Everybody else, I think, is very valid. Of the people that didn't make it, a couple of them seem like they could or will down the road. I think Donna Summer's, you know, a big figure from the 70s, and Eric B. and Rakim are major figures in rap, so any one of them could make it in.
Nintendo's legendary game designer Shigeru Miyamoto. Okay, let me say that again.
Shigeru Miyamoto.
Thank you. Is scaling back his responsibilities after decades of overseeing franchises like Mario Brothers and Zelda to get back to his first love of designing new games. The talent behind Donkey Kong and those other billion-dollar properties, Miyamoto wants to work on small-scale projects that can go from idea to app in just 1 year. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. He's a legend in the industry. He's been overseeing these huge, huge properties. I mean, you know, Zelda and Mario Brothers are as big as it gets when you talk about video games. And the fact that he wants to sort of scale back his responsibilities and yet possibly create some new games that people can get excited about again, it's a very exciting news.
Yeah,
it's also, you know, an ending of an era for Nintendo because he has been a fixture there for decades.
Yeah, no, he is Nintendo, frankly.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, if Spielberg said, you know, I think I'm going to stop this blockbuster stuff and walk away from DreamWorks and Amblin. I'm just going to make, you know, some small home movies and see what happens.
Yeah.
It's no urban legend. A cannonball went tearing through a California suburb recently. The team behind Mythbusters, albeit not the two hosts, were on a police firing range and testing a cannonball firing for an upcoming episode. Unfortunately, the cannon was aimed too high and the cannonball went 700 yards off course, bouncing off a roof, blasting a hole in a home, and landing on a van. Luckily, no one was injured, and the show, which has an excellent safety record, by the way, is determined to make sure nothing like it happens again. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, thank God, because nobody was hurt. They're obviously paying for the damages and people to stay in hotels while their home get fixed. It's just a miracle that nobody got hurt, and I know they're heaving a huge sigh of relief. Obviously, they don't have a history of injuring people while they work out the stunts that they do on the show, so they're going to want to be careful in the future and figure out what went wrong, but it's very, very lucky that it's just a big whoop.
Yeah, and it's not a stunt show like, say, Fear Factor.
No.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically these two guys who are into science, and they say, well, you know, here's an urban myth, an urban legend. Let's see if it could actually happen. The Justice Department is looking into the pricing of ebooks. I found this story fascinating. Should content creators like publishers and music companies be allowed to set a minimum price on their products? Music companies watched as music stores were forced out of business partially by retailers like Best Buy selling CDs at a loss to get customers into their stores. Now publishers are worried about Amazon doing the same thing to bookstores. But the Justice Department is looking at the talks between publishers and Apple to push the ebook industry towards so-called agency pricing, where the publisher sets a price and the seller gets a percentage, rather than the wholesale model, where stores buy books and then sell them for whatever price they want. The result could be lower prices for consumers, but fewer outlets selling books and more power in the hands of Amazon. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It could be an inside baseball story down the road. Basically, Amazon sells books at a loss. You know, when they let you borrow a book once a month in their library lending program, they're paying the publisher the full price of the book and taking a loss. And they're doing all this to extend their reach in the domain. And the problem is that down the road, once they have the massive market share, will they pull back and then be able to do whatever they want? So stores and Apple and other people got together to try and figure out some alternative. And then the Justice Department steps in and says, wait a second, you can't collude like that. So it's really a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. And it's complicated and difficult. And what's going to be best for consumers is not always the lowest price in the short term. You know, the lowest price now may hurt you 2 years from now when you discover that there are no music stores left in your city, which is what you have in New York and all around the country. And that's what's happened. And it could happen the same for bookstores. And that's why this is a very complex, difficult issue.
Yes, in the EU, in fact, which is investigating the same thing with ebooks, they are, you know, you can't price ebooks differently from trade
physical
paper. Yeah, I mean, I think in some territories, I have to.
But which format do they decide on?
You know what? I actually, before I get too involved in this or too deep into this, I should really do some research. I read it recently that the ebook price is kind of not moderated, but regulated in some of the EU countries, and that the EU is looking into this practice. But
interesting.
Yeah, I have to. Singer Sinead O'Connor, remember her? Well, mm-hmm. She's marrying husband number four. We reported previously about Grammy-winning singer Sinead O'Connor taking out a personal ad looking for a man. And you know what? I don't understand. She didn't respond to any of my... Which cheekily listed the many attributes she was looking for. And, you know...
I think single was one of the attributes she was looking for, Sperling.
Oh, good point. That was back in August. Apparently, it worked out because she's getting married again. In a bid to challenge Elizabeth Taylor in the husband sweepstakes, O'Connor is marrying husband number four just weeks after meeting him. Not to worry, the ceremony is taking place in Las Vegas, so it's sure to last. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, obviously, but, you know, congratulations to her, and I hope it's a wonderful, long, happy marriage.
Yeah, I find this story just so funny that that's why.
Well, I love Sinead O'Connor. She's a great talent. I hope he centers her and then she feels warm and happy and goes back to creating some great music again.
And then her marriage lasts longer than the 11 months her last marriage lasted, which ended only in what, March of this year?
Yeah, something recent. God bless her.
Yeah. Fox executives are in about the worst negotiating position possible when it comes to the NFL, just like CBS, ESPN, and NBC. Fox's deal expires in 2012, and they're clearly ready to sign on the dotted line. They desperately want to take a firm stand on huge price increases, but are incapable of even hinting that they might not sign up for another decade. Estimates are that Fox's deal could jump up from $720 million to $1 billion. Yes, a year. Though that does include some 102 games per season on the Sunday NFC. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
So Fox is getting ready to re-up with the NFL for their football package, which takes place on Sundays. It's 100 games. It's going to cost them $1 billion. They have no choice. They took in about $975 million last year on the games that they paid $700 million to get the rights to. Then, of course, they have to pay for all the people to put the show on, the on-air talent, the directors, the producers, the writers, and that's expensive. So it's almost a break-even proposition at this point. At some point, the NFL will be charging too much money, but, you know, it's just the biggest game in town for TV ratings for all these networks. And what choice do they have? The NFL has them over a barrel.
So it's a big deal.
It's a very big deal.
The Russian biopic, Vysotsky, Grateful to Be Alive, is a box office phenomenon that came out December 2nd and in 10 days became the highest grossing movie of the year. And yet, no one knows who stars in it. The movie is about an iconic actor, singer, and songwriter of the 60s and 70s who died in 1980 at the age of 42. The producers said they searched and searched for an actor to play this famous figure and finally decided that no one existed who could do it and chose to use makeup and CGI to turn an unnamed actor into Vysotsky. The credits include no mention of the actor who played the title role, though people believe it's popular actor Sergei Bezrukhov? Sergei Bezrukhov. I hope I'm not butchering that name. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal for two levels. One, producers love the idea of a movie where they don't have a star. So they have a movie about this guy, and they don't even tell you who the actor is that's playing him. That's amazing. But two, Vysotsky is a big figure in Russia. He's sort of a rebellious figure. He was not part of the official Soviet culture. He wasn't part of the establishment, and yet he had huge fame. And I think the fact that you saw tens of thousands of people in Moscow protesting the Vladimir Putin's, you know, basically dictatorship of the country, I think this ties into what's going on in Russia and around the world as far as people wanting figures that they can embrace who are outside the establishment and outside the power structure. So I think it's a big deal. And he represents this desire for outspokenness and people who are not tied into the power structure.
For one day, screenwriters are proud that their script hasn't been turned into a feature film. What day is that? It's the day Franklin Leonard, an executive at Overbrook Entertainment and former guest on Showbiz Sandbox, releases his annual survey of the 10 best unproduced screenplays in Hollywood. This year's list includes a spoof of Star Wars that must be smarter than Spaceballs and Father-Daughter Time, a tale of armed robbery and Eskimo kisses, among others. That sounded like one long name of a film. But they were all different titles. Topping the list is The Imitation Game by Graham Moore. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for the people involved. It does bring attention to these scripts. A lot of them are by little known writers, so it helps give them a boost. Past people who've been highlighted include the screenplays for Juno and The Social Network. So it's a big deal for them. Do you know any of these scripts, Sperling?
I don't know them offhand, no. We should get Franklin Leonard on maybe and have him go over this year's batch of nominee. I don't know. They're not nominated. They're effectively entries on the list, right?
That's right. They made the list.
Yeah. Okay. Van Halen and David Lee Roth are going to perform at the Grammys. The Grammys hinted strongly that on their live nomination show, they would be announcing that Van Halen would be performing on the Grammy Awards with all the original members on board. But the band wasn't quite ready to make the jump, get it? So the announcement was pulled. Now it looks like they're still trying to work things out in time for the big show, but no official word yet. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, but, you know, it'd be fun to see them on the Grammys.
Well, Michael, I think a story about Van Halen and potentially reuniting is a really good segue from Big Deal or Big Whoop into this week's Inside Baseball, which is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, and I've been really, I couldn't wait to have both Josh Barron and Dean Budnick on because they wrote a book that I was riveted by. It's called Ticketmasters, and its tagline is The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Scalped. And it's a as you know, Michael, a topic I'm fascinated with, but it goes through the entire history of the modern concert industry with hundreds of interviews with every player you can imagine. Now, Josh and Dean, thank you for joining us to talk about this book. It's really fascinating.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thank you for having us.
So I was trying to figure out where we should begin talking about the modern concert industry. And the only place I could figure that we should start is where you guys started, which is at the very beginning of this story, which it took place in New York City. But it was all about technology at the time. And it was filled with people who were trying to figure out how to create a way to sell tickets for Broadway theater. Is that correct?
Yes. The idea behind it was for many, many years, and for many years actually following this initial meeting, tickets were held in racks in the box office, and there were many opportunities that simply weren't realized because people wanted to buy in advance, people wanted to buy tickets who did not live anywhere near the New York City box offices. And as a result of that, an enterprising Broadway producer by the name of George W. George, whose father happened to be Rube Goldberg, decided that he would initiate some type of computer-aided ticketing process. And that ultimately led to a company called Ticket Reservation Systems, which ultimately led to Ticketron, which really was the big gorilla before Ticketmaster came around.
Yeah, I mean, this was in the like mid to late 60s, and it slowly started to build up. And what I found fascinating was all these Broadway ticket brokers and the ticket box office managers, they were kind of playing fast and loose with the rules and with the tickets, and they were making more money kind of doing backdoor deals than they were at their jobs, their legitimate jobs. And all of a sudden, these electronic ticketing and these computerized ticketing services came about, and so did their livelihood kind of dried up. Isn't that right, Josh?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what they did so well is that they sort of combined their regular jobs, you know, trying to, you know, sort of sell tickets to anyone that was interested in them, in addition to sort of selling tickets, you know, behind closed doors or sort of under the table, or, you know, there was a, you know, they would sell tickets to hotels rather frequently. And it was a very popular sort of thing to do and was a very legitimate thing to do. And they would tack on service fees there. And so patrons at the hotel could, you know, get tickets to the Haas Broadway shows. And it was a very accepted practice that, you know, to some extent is carried through in various iterations today.
So, Dean, the book's gotten great reviews. Rolling Stone gave it a very strong review. Library Journal, Kirkus, The Wall Street Journal called it a clear, comprehensive look at a murky business. And I think when fans are hearing about the book and deciding whether to read it, they want to know, who do I blame? And the fascinating thing about this book is that you don't blame Ticketmaster, despite the play on words that you use at the top of the book. There's a lot of blame to go around as far as you guys are concerned.
Yeah, you know, I think Josh and I came into this book. Perhaps our initial inclination was to blame Ticketmaster. We both came of age during the Pearl Jam hearings when Fred Rosen and Ticketmaster were very much vilified. But I think as we try to answer the question that really frames the book, why are ticket prices so high? The two of us really began to consider all of the factors there, and there are plenty of people and artists and just a variety of individuals to blame, including the performer.
Right. I mean, that's a big thing for me. I've always looked at acts like Garth Brooks and Green Day, who maintain lower ticket prices. And I say, well, they're big superstar acts. And if they decide to do it, clearly other acts have that power as well. Same thing with the scalping, where you see people like Bruce Springsteen and others. They take some reasonable steps to try and fight scalping. But we all know the stories about how acts hold back tickets, sell them for inflated prices through brokers and things like that. And you know that if they say, well, all right, if you want to buy a ticket, show up at the box office with your ID to pick it up and then have to go right in, there you go. You've taken care of your scalping and counterfeit business. But a lot of acts don't do that because there's a lot of money to be made. Isn't that right, Dean?
Well, this is Josh. I mean, I think yes and no. I mean, listen, I think some of what you're referring to is sort of what we think of as paperless ticketing or, you know, sort of very restrictive types of ticketing. And, you know, in the new chapter we just wrote, for the paperback edition, which will come out in April, you know, we talked to several, you know, sort of mid-level brokers that have told us in no uncertain terms that there are plenty of ways around paperless ticketing, that even with these IDs and these measures, brokers are still going to get tickets. Does it stop some of the flow of tickets? Absolutely. Is it a perfect solution? Not by a long shot. So, yeah, I mean, I think, but to your earlier point that we do hold the artist accountable, that if an artist is, you know, fans get outraged by expensive tickets a long time, they want to blame Ticketmaster. You know, Ticketmaster does not set the ticket price. Do they affect the bottom line of it? Certainly, but they do not, by any means, control the majority of the ticket price. It's really at the artists. Who do that. And, you know, we argue, and it's a foreign concept to a lot of general consumers, but the artist is the true monopoly in this business because there's only one Rolling Stones, there's only one Madonna, there's only one Barbra Streisand. So, you know, they control, they wield a tremendous amount of power. And so if they want to keep ticket prices low, they can. But obviously, you know, they do. If they really do not want to sell tickets to the secondary market, which, as you point out, a lot of artists do, and they make a lot of money, just like Van Halen did on that last reunion tour. You know, they made several million dollars extra. You know, it does take a considerable effort, but it can be done. But, you know, the struggle is that, you know, by doing that, are you alienating some of the more casual fans that might want to come to the show versus just your hardcore fans? Because even if you're a super popular band like Pearl Jam, let's say, or the Kings of Leon, or whoever it is playing your local arena, while there's plenty of people in there that are your, you know, super hardcore fans, there's a lot of other people that are casual fans that are coming to experience your music for the first time that don't want to jump through a whole lot of hoops just to get in through the front door.
Well, now you write in the book, and this is a quote, "Artists help determine their ticket price based on the guarantee they're asking for. Service fees are directly scaled to ticket price. While no artist can do away with service fees, those that disappear, as with some Eagles shows, are simply charged on the quote-unquote inside of the overall ticket, artists can absolutely affect what a service fee will be. Moreover, some of the most popular artists will often tack on additional money to the service fees so as to lower the promoter's guarantee while keeping their desired take at a premium." And so I just wanted to follow up with your actual words from the book. We started kind of talking about the history here of this whole subject. We started in the 60s and 70s with this computerized ticketing. I guess I am just amazed at how many people you spoke with. So many people, in fact, in the back of your book, you have kind of a guide for or a glossary of people, because this is really a story about technology and different personalities coming together, personalities like Bill Graham, who unfortunately died in 1991 in a helicopter accident, but he was one of the biggest concert promoters of all time. But what were some of the things, Dean, that he was doing at the beginning of his career that were kind of a little shady? He wasn't always on the up and up.
Well, there were two things that he did. One thing I would contend that maybe rubbed people the wrong way, but was legit. Another one that clearly wasn't. And one thing that he would do to bypass the fire code is people would buy a ticket downstairs to get into the Fillmore, walk up, hand it to the person at the door, and then they would turn around and they'd resell the same ticket. So it would appear to everybody that a certain amount of seats had been sold, when in fact there were many more. I mean, he became so notorious for that, but there was a time when the Rolling Stones refused to take the stage at Winterland until they could see there was no one in the upper balcony all the way around, so that they knew that he hadn't oversold the venue. So that was one thing that he did. Another thing that he did that was perfectly legitimate, but you know, really opened some eyes, was he would make flat deals. So he would make flat guarantees to artists, rather giving them a percentage of the door. And particularly when rock music was really gaining momentum in the late 1960s into the early 1970s, and a lot of the artists and their agents who were just learning the business really didn't understand how to monetize all of it, he would give them a decent amount of money up front that looked like, you know, quite a bit to those performers, when in fact he was just making just a ton of dough on the other side. And in fact, you know, at some point later, someone came to visit his estate that he had and asked him, you know, how he was able to do this. And the story is that he says, well, that he gave out flat rates at the flat guarantees at the Fillmore, and that's how he made all of that extra money.
Right, and he became quite the promoter. He started in San Francisco, but then he kind of went national. But promoting and concert promoters are a very regional group, and you go into great detail about how certain certain promoters would rule the East Coast or just New York or just Boston or just Philadelphia. But that kind of changed over time. And Josh, how did that change with, I guess, who was it? It was SFX and
Robert Silverman.
Robert Silverman, yeah. And
I mean, as you noted, the country was largely defined by regional promoters. Now, there had been promoters like Jerry Weintraub with Concerts West and Michael Cole with CPI that had mounted national tours and, you know, would utilize the local or regional promoter in some capacity, but would, you know, would do the booking for the entire tour. And that, you know, didn't make a lot of people happy. And as you noted, Bill Graham tried that a little bit in the mid-70s, but stopped at the behest of the rest of the industry. In the late 90s, Robert Tillman, who had a background in radio broadcasting and buying up radio stations, and then made a fortune with the windfall of the 1996 Telecommunications Act being passed, saw an opportunity to consolidate the concert industry and to try to maximize its profits in a way that no one had done previously. And so he rather swiftly bought up nearly every major promoter around the country and created a company called SFX Entertainment. That company then became Clear Channel Entertainment, and that company, as we know today, is Live Nation Entertainment. And that created a very different playing field for artists, for managers, for agents, for the entire industry, and particularly for those that were left unbought, guys like Seth Hurwitz in D.C. or Jam Productions in Chicago. You know, there were people still, you know, trying to book shows independently, but were, you know, facing a tough challenge with such a massive company that demanded that they get the entire tour.
Because the whole thing became not about necessarily the act itself, but about the auditoriums and the amphitheaters that could be played usually during the summer, so that they could get all the ancillary revenue, whether it be merchandise or beer or and it really became more about, I guess, it didn't become about music, it seems to me. Is that more?
Yeah, and it goes back to, you know, a lot of the reliance upon ancillary revenue from amphitheaters like your beer and your parking goes back to, you know, what you and Dean were just speaking about in terms of you know, there's this cat and mouse game between promoter and artist that, you know, the promoter for years was making, you know, the lion's share of the money. Then the artist got wise and started trying to strike harder and harder deals to the point where it became untenable to a promoter that the artist was asking for 90% of the profits, you know, and to have a promoter make, you know, only 10%, you know, they could lose their shirt if a show only did okay, you know, that a promoter really made his money with the sale of a couple thousand tickets. was hard. And so it, you know, you can't blame promoters by themselves. I think a lot of people would argue that they were forced into this position of creating these amphitheaters and making money off beer and popcorn because of the artists being excessively greedy. Now, once consolidation happened, you know, the metrics and the economics of the whole thing became a little out of whack, in that, you know, artists versus being forced to play for live, you know, for SFX, for Clear Channel, being forced to take less money, turned around and said, you know what, you have to have us. You know, you have these tremendous leases, you have a huge amount of debt, you need us to play for you, we're going to charge you even more money. And if you don't give us the money, then we're not going to necessarily play just for you. We might go play for these other smaller guys. So they started extracting even more money from the promoter. So it was, it got a little haywire.
So one of the crazy stories I saw is the Jimmy Buffett, who was charging even more than they were making. It was unbelievable. I always knew he was a good businessman, but I didn't know he was quite so ruthlessly brilliant.
Well, I don't know if we can entirely credit Jimmy, but rather his managers and agents, Howard Rose and Howard Kaufman and Irving Azoff, and seeing that, you know, his Parrothead fans were going to take, you know, they were going to drink a lot of alcohol, it was rightfully Jimmy's. And so, and you also see this happen with, you know, notoriously the Rolling Stones under Michael Cole would charge very tough deals, but that was based on stadium models, and that these stadiums, if you think about it, stadiums are dark most of the time. You know, if it's a football stadium, it's got, you know, the regular season games, maybe a few playoff games, but it's typically dark after that. You know, if it's baseball, obviously that's a different story. But the opportunity for a stadium to make a lot of money on ancillary revenue was very attractive. So they could strike really tough deals. And there was some instances that we mentioned in the book that, you know, Pink Floyd was getting 110% in some of these college stadiums in the South. So, the economics have certainly changed from the early 70s.
So fans who are feeling frustrated, what do you suggest they do? I always tell people, go to smaller clubs and support acts like the Grateful Dead when they were around, or Garth Brooks, who seem to be going the extra mile to take care of you and keep prices reasonable. Is there anything else they can do to try and not feel like they're getting scalped?
Well, I think clearly that's the best way. And frankly, to see music in that kind of environment, you know, when you have some kind of proximate distance to the artist, whether it's in a club or, you know, my favorite size venue is probably like a theater, you know, where everything sound, you know, tends to sound pretty good. I mean, that's just great. I mean, you know, go out and support those developing artists. Part of the reason we wrote this book, and one of the issues that concerned us, was that if people were spending so much money going to see U2, going to see, you know, Van Morrison, Neil Young, and the like, that maybe they wouldn't have the income that they could devote to supporting younger developing acts. So I think certainly that's part of it. You know, beyond that, there are opportunities, you know, certainly as regards scalpers in the secondary market. If people really want to make sure that they spend their money wisely, a lot of times they can join, you know, artist fan clubs, which generally speaking have pretty good seats allocated to them, so that they can then have the chance. And a lot of times it doesn't cost any dough at all to become part of this. You simply get a pre-sale password, and then you can go in. At least when you see that artist, at least it'll be a good experience for you, because you'll have just a great view of the stage, and the sound will be really good. You know, beyond that, if you miss the initial on sale and you're not there at 10 o'clock, because invariably tickets are going to sell out at 10:04, what I would encourage people to do is just, you know, pay attention online to some of the secondary sites, because there are opportunities there. While many people, whether they're professional brokers or moms and pops and college students who fancy themselves ticket brokers, you know, there are many people out there who are grabbing inventory as soon as tickets go on sale. To that end, a lot of times people get desperate and they're willing to drop their price as the show comes around, or if they, you know, they want to flip it and then try to quote unquote invest in another kind in tickets to another show. So there are chances for people to sometimes do pretty well. I have a friend of mine who at this point has gone on to 18 straight shows without paying the list the list ticket price, the phase ticket price,
nice.
By being very savvy in terms of grabbing tickets as they become available on StubHub, Tickets Now, and certain sites like that.
All of which are now owned by Ticketmaster and the like. But and we mentioned the Grateful Dead just a bit, but Dean and Josh, you talked in the book about how the Grateful Dead had their own ticketing service, and I think it was, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it was fascinating how they were making a lot of money doing just ticketing. In fact, Pearl Jam was going to use them at one point, or thought about using them, to do their 1994 tour, which of course is kind of an infamous tour because it, you know, imploded and never really happened. And at the time, and it was my belief that this all was because of Ticketmaster, that Pearl Jam wanted to create or wanted to charge $18 per ticket, and Ticketmaster was throwing on this enormous service charge, and they went to Congress and they testified. But Josh, I mean, in the book, you kind of go into what really happened, and can you tell us how it really wasn't Ticketmaster's fault?
Well, it wasn't necessarily Ticketmaster's fault. Was Ticketmaster certainly applying some pressure? Yeah, definitely. But you know, part of the issue, as we've talked a little bit about, so you know, already, is that, you know, Ticketmaster was not in a position to suddenly adjust all of their fees. You know, there was a set schedule of what the fees would be based on ticket price. So Pearl Jam said, well, we want to make this amount of money. We don't want you to make any more than this amount of money. And that's just simply not how the concert industry worked or works today. So, you know, as we quote someone from Green Day, Trey Cool from Green Day, saying, hey, listen, if you want the service fee to be lower, lower your price. You don't want it to be, you know, you don't want it to, the ticket to go over $20. Well, maybe you should be asking for $17 and you can keep it under the $20 cap. But, you know, what happened was, and it was, you know, Pearl Jam realized it was a bit, not ironic, but it was not doing them a whole lot of good in their case against Ticketmaster, is that they successfully launched their own ticketing company and successfully did a tour with that Ticketmaster. Now, that being said, they were playing less than ideal places. They were playing ski slopes and racetracks and, you know, stuff that were not Madison Square Garden or these premier theaters around the country.
Right. I mean, eventually they just said, you know what, this is just way too hard. We're just going to have to play some Ticketmaster places, because not only for the money,
right,
but because it's just too hard. And in the end, their own service fee was $2.45 instead of the $2.50 that Ticketmaster wanted to charge. So they were actually proving Ticketmaster's case in to Congress was, look, there is competition. You don't need to use us.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, there is something to be said for the fact that Ticketmaster did control a number of the premier venues in the country. However, if the argument is, can a band tour across this country and, you know, play then? Yes, they could. You know, Ticketmaster did not and does not have a monopoly on music venues across this country. It's been proven time and again. But, you know, it certainly, they did not make life easy for Pearl Jam, and they certainly did not want Pearl Jam to set a precedent, you know, because as we talk about in the book, in 1991, the Grateful Dead set a very big precedent in their battle with Ticketmaster. And, you know, the company was not of the mind to let another band that was significantly younger than the Grateful Dead, you know, come along and sort of dictate how things were going to run. And, you know, I think Ticketmaster was very effective in, you know, as much bad publicity as they got, that company thrived. And they did quite well. And they continued to do quite well for, you know, many, many years after. And they still do quite well. So, you know, they're very good. You know, what people tend to forget, and as much as they bemoan and sort of, excuse me for saying it, bitch about Ticketmaster, Ticketmaster is very good at what they do. You know, computerized ticketing, particularly with the amount of volume you're dealing with for the shows and the demand on these servers, it's very hard to accomplish. And it takes a lot of technology, a lot of wherewithal to complete it. And Ticketmaster, you know, say what you will about them, they deliver. You know, you feel secure when you do get those tickets. You know, that's a separate issue. But when you do get the tickets, you feel very secure in that transaction. And, you know, there is something to be said for that.
Well, yeah, and that's how Ticketmaster kind of won over all the venues, was that they could handle the volume. Dealing with them was easy, and they always delivered.
If you don't mind, let me interject. I mean, that, to my mind, that's part of how they won over the venues. But ultimately, the way they won over the venues really, I think, set us down the path to the point where we are today. Because prior to this point, again, the dominant company was Ticketron. And the way that Ticketron monetized its business is it would charge the public 25 cents per ticket, and then it would charge the venues 25 cents per ticket. And so Ticketron made 50 cents per ticket off all of these transactions. It was very happy. 25 cents from the public, 25 cents from the venue or promoter that used its service. And then what happened is that Fred Rosen came along in 1982, and he took over Ticketmaster, and he viewed things a little bit differently. And so he went to a number of these venues and said, listen, instead of charging the public 25 cents, what if we charge the public $3? And the venues at first said, well, gee, no, that's a terrible idea. Why would we want to charge the public $3 if right now all we're charging them is 25 cents? And Fred Rosen said, well, if we charge them $3, I'll keep $1.50, you keep $1.50. And so all of a sudden, instead of losing, being forced to pay 25 cents per ticket, all of these venues had the opportunity to see this new revenue stream of $1.50 per ticket. And once the promoters and the agents and the bands and the venues and everyone saw that there was this opportunity to make this new revenue stream, that's when everything changed. That's when everyone wanted a piece of it. And it was then collectively over the course of the next decade or so that everyone began to want bigger and bigger pieces. And at some point, when you can't carve up the pie any finer, you just have to make a bigger pie. And the people buying those humongous pies, you know, are the concertgoers.
I remember in 1989 seeing the Steel Wheels tour at Shea Stadium. It was $35 and everybody was up in arms. Oh my goodness, how could this be? $35 is so expensive. Now to see the Rolling Stones, it'll cost you, you know, for a bad seat, $500. So ticket prices surely have gone through the roof in part because of this. But and you really do a great job of explaining it in the book, Ticketmasters. I was reading this book and thinking, my God, this must have taken a decade or more to put together. How did you guys put this book together and interview all of the, I mean, there's hundreds of interviews here with people like Michael Cole and, you know, Fred Rosen. How in the world did you research and put this book together, and how long did it take?
You know, it was something that we've been thinking about for quite a few years. And, you know, when we eventually got down to it and signed a contract, all said and done, I think it took us about 3 years to complete start to finish. You know, we divided up the chapters of between the two of us, and you know, we were both, you know, we would interview people separately, but a lot of the stuff that the interviews we were doing were germane to one another's chapters and what we were writing. So you know, it took a little while to get the critical mass in terms of the people that we'd interviewed. And once we'd interviewed enough people, then the, you know, as you may find, there's a lot of ego in this business. And I think once we got enough people, a nice laundry list, people thought, oh, well, you talked to him. Well, you need to hear my side of the story. And they were, you know, very happy to speak with us. You know, it was hard to pin some of them down, but, you know, we basically spoke to nearly everyone that we set out to speak to.
Yeah, I mean, some of those stories, it was like Rashomon. You'd hear, you know, Fred Rosen's side, and then you'd hear the Grateful Dead side. It was quite interesting. In fact, I'm surprised that some of these people were willing to talk, given that, you know, for a long time, they didn't really want to talk about what went on in the concert industry because it wasn't necessarily on the up and up. But did you find it difficult to get people to speak?
I think what happened, as Josh explained, is that once people heard that we'd interviewed other people, they really did want to get their side of the story told. Just like Rashomon and the Grateful Dead and the meeting up in the Hyatt Regency. You know, Fred knew that we'd spoken with a lot of people on the Grateful Dead side, and he wanted to get his own part of the story told as well. The other thing is, we really started to gain critical mass, and once we did, people, I think, understood that we had a real good sense of what was going on. We were going to try to portray it fairly, and people went out of their way to help us. There are a lot of people who are not mentioned in the back of the book who contributed really dramatically in terms of giving us information, telling us stories, telling us other people that we might not have thought of to interview. I mean, at some point, it really did sort of feel like a collective endeavor in that, you know, a lot of the people who we interviewed along the way, who were both credited or uncredited, really seemed to be on our side and wanted to help us tell the story and tell it the right way. And in some respects, that's really been one of the gratifying aspects of the reception that the book has received, is I sort of feel like it validates all of us along the way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we, as Dean said, it took a little while for people, oh, wow, they're writing a book about the Katya mystery, you know, and yeah, they're just going to blame Ticketmaster, it's going to be a hit piece. But once we sort of talked to people and said, listen, no, we really want to understand how it works, and we think there's been a lot of misperception amongst the public about how it operates, and we want to figure it out, we want to try to tell it, people were very into it and saying, okay, this is a bit of a different interview, and particularly from a historical perspective, people were very interested in telling those stories because they weren't known or they hadn't been told in a long time, and they're very proud of the work that they had done. But I think, as Dean said, that the industry has responded well. I mean, you know, we can legitimately say that Live Nation and Ticketmaster have read this book and have said, you know what, you guys got it right. You know, yes, I'm sure they have a few quibbles here and there, but generally speaking, they've said, listen, you did a good job. And so when it came time to speak for the next chapter, you know, we were able to speak to the top brass at Ticketmaster and Live Nation because they trusted us to, you know, tell I hate to use the term, but a fair and balanced story.
Well, yeah, and I have to say, you guys did a great job on the book. It's well worth reading. I mean, we didn't even touch on Live Nation and Ticketmaster and that merger, and we could talk. I mean, I could talk to you guys all day. It is a subject that really interests me, and I'm sure interests our audience. And I'd like to thank both of you, Josh Barron and Dean Budnick. The book, again, is Ticketmaster's The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Scalped. It's well worth picking up. Anybody who is interested in music and the music industry you will not be able to put it down. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, it's greater than to take the time to come by. The book is out available now. It's on Kindle, I think, for like $10. It's in hardcover. You can get it for $14 or $15 online. And there'll be a paperback edition with an update coming out in, I think, April, they said.
Yes. And I was really excited to have them on. And I've been looking forward to having them on for a couple of months now, as you know, Michael. So I'm glad we got to talk to them. I have to say, really, when I said that we could talk to them all day about some of these subjects, it is such an in-depth book. We barely brushed the surface.
That's right. And they can follow the links to their book and their magazine, Relics, etc.
Yes, that's true. They are the editors of Relics magazine. We will place links to it in the show notes. In fact, if you want to look up the show notes, you can do so on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find links to the ways you can subscribe to us. You can subscribe to us in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher. In fact, you can rate and rank us there, and please do and submit a review. We'd appreciate it. You can also find on our website ways to follow us. Our Twitter handle is ShowbizSandbox, and you can like us on Facebook. The username to look up is ShowbizSandbox. Links to all of the stories will appear in the show notes on ShowbizSandbox. You can also find ways to call us on our website. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or if you prefer, you can email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Call us, email us. We might read your email or play your voicemail on a future episode. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael has a website. Michael, how do we get in touch with you?
Go to michaelgiltz.com and you'll find all the information you need.
All of your work from the Huffington Post and other outlets can be found there. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.